Grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Support for today's broadcast comes from Pines Plus Waterscapes and Nature's Way Incorporated, now carrying neem oil, a naturally organic product with many uses around the home. Information on neem oil is at Pines Plus Waterscapes, Champaign, 355-2266, or Nature's Way Incorporated in Effingham, 800-369-1247.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Tom Rogers, and for Celeste Quinn, Henry Frain is our technical director. We bring you an archived version of the Afternoon Magazine from back in May, so we are not taking phone calls this afternoon.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. I'm Celeste Quinn. Good afternoon. Thanks for tuning in today. When she was a girl in small town Indiana, she coveted the sandwiches of her classmates, bologna, cheese, Miracle Whip. In her lunchbox were delicious balls of rice surrounding tender delicacies prepared by her mother. But what Linda Furia craved was to be like the other kids. On the program today, we'll talk with Linda about the pride she felt as a girl for her Japanese parents and her desire to fit in. Linda Furia tells the story of her coming of age in the memoir Bento Box in the Heartland, My Japanese Girlhood and White Bread America. She tells the story of her coming of age with stories of food and family. The Japanese dishes the family enjoyed provided them with a link to their history and culture. She says being at table together was her family's communion. It was how they communicated. And that's why interspersed within this memoir are some of the family's favorite recipes, including rice balls, Japanese barbecue, fried pork dumplings, and Japanese-style omelet. Linda Furia grew up in rural Indiana. She graduated from Purdue. She has lived in Washington, D.C., San Diego, San Francisco, Beijing, and Shanghai. She currently lives in Shelburne, Vermont, with her son, where she writes and teaches Japanese and Chinese cooking. She's written a self-syndicated column, which was published in several Japanese, American, and Canadian newspapers. Bento Box in the Heartland, nominated for the 2007 Great Lakes Book Award, is published by Seal Press. That's an imprint of Avalon. Linda, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Am I doing okay with your name?
Yes, Linda Furia. Yes.
Okay, excellent. Yeah. Well, to begin, would you tell us what is a bento and what is a bento box?
Well, a bento box, it's basically a lunch box. And it is quite iconic of Japanese culture. I think when my mother was growing up, everyone brought bento boxes to work for their lunches or for dinner, and all the school children. I think they still do bring bento boxes. And, of course, now they're made in restaurants and in fast food places. But typically for me, when I was growing up, it symbolized, and the way my mother described it to me, was a lunch prepared at home, and it's not like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich or a Snoopy lunchbox sort of lunch, but in a very very simple flat container. And when you open it up, it has little segments where you can put like pickled vegetables or some nice flavored meats, and of course rice. And usually there's umeboshi in the middle of the rice, which is preserved plum. And usually that gives it that Japanese flag look because you put it right in the middle. Mm. And it it's like a flavor, a taste, a symbol of home that a person takes to them to, you know, during their busy day at work or at school, to remind them that someone at home loves them because they put so much care and thought into this lunch. And of course, you know, Japanese are very into aesthetics, and so these are prepared, you know, with aesthetics in mind and how the food is arranged and how it looks.
Yeah. I went to the internet and put into the browser bento box, and I saw some amazing things, just beautiful boxes and beautifully arranged food items in them.
Right.
Just glorious.
Yeah, it takes a lot of, really, I mean, the bento box, and there's also books out that show you, you know, different ideas or different things to prepare. You know, mostly it's leftovers, but, you know, there's a lot of thought put into it and, you know, color and, you know, how it looks as soon as you open it up. It's like a palette, you know, you know, like a picture in a frame.
Yeah. Well, now what was in your bento box as a girl?
Well, that fateful week, when I was in first grade, the first thing my mother had was she made me the rice balls. And, it was funny because in that story, you know, I did it because I wanted to be like my friends, because this was like sort of the end thing to do, and it was so different from the cafeteria food that I had gotten tired of very quickly. And it was interesting because, you know, we went out to Gold Circle and we bought, you know, a Snoopy lunchbox, and it had the thermos and everything in it. So it had all the trappings of like a typical American, you know, lunch that you'd bring from home. And I guess I assume my mom got it. Like she knew that I wanted like a cheese sandwich with, you know, some Kraft singles between, you know, Wonder Bread and, you know, some mayonnaise slapped on that and some potato sticks and maybe an apple or some cookies. So I think I didn't, you know, of course, looking back, of course she didn't know. She had no idea. And so, you know, when I found the rice balls, I was in shock. And it was, I think there was other foods too. There was, shade, other little jacket bits and stuff throughout the week. And, all of that I had to eat in secrecy. And luckily there were things like some cookies and some, you know, carrots and, you know, things like that to throw my friends off. But the main food was Japanese. So I just made it through that week, I remember.
Yeah.
And I never asked ever again to have her make me lunch. Yeah. I don't think I ever brought lunch to school after that, actually.
Yeah. Other than food, were there things that set you apart from your classmates?
Yeah, my two older brothers and I, we were the only students of color, of any color, you know, in my school. And so when you're looking out in the world and all you see is, you know, Caucasian faces, you too. So as I got older, it was always a shock for me when, you know, I would get teased or there'd be a comment about me looking different or a comment about, you know, us being the only, you know, Japanese or, you know, ethnic family or kids in the school, because I didn't see myself that way. So so it was sort of a constant unexpected reminder that happened every so often. Yeah. Some were pleasant and some weren't so pleasant.
Yeah. Maybe you tell us about the scene at your friend Tracy's house and how it was different from life at your house and how you eventually arranged to have Tracy sleep over. And that caused you a lot of anxiety.
Yeah, yeah. I have a chapter, I think it's called The Sleepover, and it starts off, I describe my friend Tracy's home, and she lived on a farm, and, you know, like a lot of farms, the relatives' aunts and uncles and cousins all live nearby so they could help out. So she lived really basically next door to her grandparents, and Tracy had, I thought, the most beautiful, girly bedroom that I'd ever seen. I mean, it's straight out of JCPenney's, you know, the princess bedroom suite with the canopy and the pink walls and the sort of, you know, Rococo-style bedroom suite with the matching desk and the vanity and glitter on her ceiling and, you know, just just the perfect princess bedroom, and she got to eat TV dinners in front of the TV at night, you know, when her parents were busy and stuff. And it was just a really casual household. And even how they dined, they would sometimes, when I would go over there, if their father was around and stuff, they would really set the table, and there would be coasters, which I didn't even know what that was back then. There'd be coasters, and, we'd sit and, talk quietly at the table. and then her grandparents lived next door, and so we got to run around around the barnyard area, and she had cows and chickens, and we used to feed the chickens, and her grandparents. I didn't have any immediate relatives, and so I was, fascinated by her relatives. Her aunts and uncles were always around helping, and her cousins were always running around, and, her grandparents were always there, and her grandmother was like the storybook grandmother. She would make little sweets for us out of the pie crust and, chase me around and things like that. It was just really, to me, looking back, it was just extremely Americana. And then back at my house, we lived in town, and, you had to take your shoes off. And back then, people didn't take their shoes off before they came into the house and stuff. And so you had to take your shoes off, which was kind of strange for a lot of people, because they, that's like, sometimes that's like, asking someone to take some sort of garment off is always sort of uncomfortable. And, my mom had Japanese knickknacks in the cabinet, and Japanese calligraphy on the walls. And, it was just kind of different. We had chopsticks out and the soy sauce and the Japanese spices and things like that. And to me, it's like I looked around the house and every corner had something that kind of screamed that our family was different. And my fear was always, how is this going to be interpreted?
Mm-hmm.
And I had enough things happen in the past where I expected a negative reaction. So I was really fearful of having someone come around. And also when we ate at the table, Japanese people, Asians eat fish whole with the heads on and everything. So, and my father, he just enjoys eating. And if we had like pork chops or anything that had bones, he would strip that bone clean of every bit of meat. And he just ate with so much enthusiasm. It wasn't quiet eating, and it was very chaotic. My mom and dad would be yelling at each other from the kitchen of the table, and, there would be food flying out of his mouth, and so it was just really chaotic. And at that age, I thought it would be embarrassing. So I would go often to my friend's house and sleep over, and I really enjoyed it. And then finally came the chance where I did not reciprocate the invitation, and my friend, she didn't like that, and she, confronted me and said that, I would like, you've never invited me over to your house. So that put me in the position where I had to invite her, which was extremely stressful for me because I was so afraid of losing her friendship if she saw how I lived. Like, I thought that she would judge me in a negative way. But, of course, as an adult now, of course she wouldn't, because she was my best friend. So, I talked to my mom, suggested it to my mom, hoping that she would not fall for it. But instead she's like, yeah, we should invite Tracy over. And so Tracy comes over, and I'm just stressed out the entire time, and I'm seeing my house through her eyes, and how my mother speaks, and how we have what we have for dinner, and the things that she sees around the house, and so it was just very interesting to kind of project what I thought that she was thinking. And I don't want to give away the story, but it doesn't turn out as a negative situation for me, and it turned out to be a surprisingly good experience for me. And then I also learned a lot about my mother at that time, during that experience.
Yeah, your mom and her cooking won Tracy over.
Yes.
Yeah.
And her uniqueness, like the things that she knew how to do, like the origami, and her tales of living in Japan, things that I thought, she would think was weird or strange. She was like totally interested in that.
Yeah. This town in Indiana that you write about, in Illinois, we have a town by the same name, and we pronounce it Versailles. Is that how it's pronounced in Indiana?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It does seem a bit unlikely, this community, for a family like yours. And one day when you were 7 years old, you asked your dad, why are we here?
Mm-hmm.
And he told you a story of old Japan.
Yeah, he told me, and I see that as a wonderful, folkloric story. And he told me this. He told me the story actually several times, so that's why I remember it so well. It's in the summertime, and I had a tough first year in school, and that was the first time I really thought about what are we doing here of all places? I mean, how did we end up here? Where it occurred to me, we're the only people. We are different from everybody else, and what brought us here? And my father, I brought this question to my father during the summertime, and he told me a story about his forefathers from a long time ago. He was telling me that he comes from the samurai lineage, and he was telling me a story about our forefathers, who was a daimyo back in probably, I think, like 1100, and it was, wartime. And it was a love story in connection. And, of course, my father's a great storyteller, of this story, how much is true and how much it isn't doesn't really matter to me. I just think it was a great story, and it really lifted my spirits. But basically it was a love story between two Japanese clans. And there was a war, a battle for the love of this woman. And on my father's side, he lost, so he was basically tasked out, in that area, instead of being killed, which is actually a worse punishment than actually being killed. And all he was given was his sword that was broken, and a bow and arrow. And he was a broken man, and he just wandered the land, and just this lost soul, and people remembered seeing this nobleman walking, and these tattered royal clothes, but underneath wearing the straw cape and the straw sandals. And one day he came across very, very far away from where he came from, and he came across this farmer, and he said to this farmer, I'm gonna cast this arrow, and where it lands, I'm gonna start my new life in a new kingdom. And this arrow just soared through the air all the way to the horizon, and no one ever saw where it went. And he followed that arrow, just started walking towards it, and no one ever saw him ever again. And my father, he ended that story, and he said that his arrow landed there in Indiana, and that's how he ended up there.
Yeah, so many wonderful stories in your family, and they all, in one way or another, maybe they're not so much about what's being talked about directly, but they're teaching something. They're teaching an important lesson.
Yeah. And I hate to say that at the time when I was growing up, I don't think I really got it. It really wasn't until I became older and started living as an adult on my own that these stories kind of came to me.
Mm-hmm.
And as I talked to more people, because I think that a lot of kids, when you grow up, you kind of take your parents for granted, of course.
Yeah.
And I think I certainly did. And, my father would tell me his POW stories and his experiences as adopted son. And I just remember at the time, it'd be like, I've heard this for 15 times, and, this is Dad telling his POW stories again. But it wasn't until I graduated from college and started working and started talking to people and hearing about other people's stories, and I'm just like, oh my goodness, my father's experience. I mean, what character and what strength he had to do that, because I hadn't lived my life yet to understand what struggling was. And his experiences and my mom's experiences, I really did not appreciate it until I was definitely in my 30s.
Well, yeah. Well, when you were a kid, like all of us, taking our parents for granted when we're young, we see mom and dad. You use this wonderful metaphor, mom and dad like salt and pepper. Always been together, and it's always on the table, and they're always there. So yeah, your father's story is truly amazing, and your mom's too, but your dad's story is just, it's like something right out of a movie.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, and you know, for all the things that he experienced. I mean, you know, starting from the age of, you know, 4 when his mother died, and he was born in the early 20s. So he's in his mid-80s now. You know, he is, I've got to say, the most appreciative, jolly, positive-thinking person I know. I mean, there's so much to be unhappy about and so much to be bitter about, but he has never, ever complained about anything, about his life. And I think that has a lot to do with, you know, I think he knew after the war and he came back to the States and, you know, he achieved his goal of getting his citizenship reinstated. I think in his heart he knew what he wanted, and that was a really simple life. And I think that coming to Indiana and living in rural Indiana was the simplicity that he wanted.
Yeah. Near the end of the book, you tell a story that I think is really special. I believe you're about to go away to school, and this would be to college, and you're sitting down with your parents for a very special meal, and your dad tells you, aha, you are like the way I was when I was young. You save the best part of your food for last, but, he said, really, you should eat the best first.
Right. Yeah, I think enjoy what right. what you have now.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, it can be seen in many ways. I mean, I see it now at the age of 40 is, you know, don't wait for something to happen, or you know this circumstance or this factor before doing something. Go for it and do it, because you're not gonna. There are all sorts of things that could happen, and you may never get the chance. And I have to say, I do live my life that way. I think I've always, I think I learned that early on, if anything. I think that I have that, I have more of that in him from my father than my brothers do.
Yeah.
To just, you know, to go for it. I mean, I think to his chagrin, too, because there are so many times where I've done things and my parents are like, you know, you know, quitting my job or doing something to go off and do something. You know, especially when I went to China. And I'm like, well, you did the same thing. you left what you were used to in Japan and you came to the States. I mean, my father, and then my mom, too. I mean, she left, you know, she had a great job at Mitsubishi Bank in Tokyo, and, you know, her father, you know, had a rice business, a very successful rice business, and, you know, so she left her motherland to go and marry a guy that she had never even seen in person. And I'm just like, that's huge compared to me just, you know, going to Beijing, you know, to live and quitting my job.
Yeah.
So, and they would never have any response to that.
She's got a point, Dad.
Right, exactly. It's like, well.
Yeah. I want to share just a little bit more detail with our listeners about your father. Mm-hmm. He's an American citizen, born in California. He was sent to Japan to be raised by his grandmother at the age of 4, and I'm reading this from Linda's book. After the death of his mother, he was stripped of his U.S. citizenship during World War II and drafted by the Imperial Army. After being captured by the Russians and held in their POW camp for 3 years, he returned to Tokyo, where he waited 10 years for his citizenship reinstatement. And then when he got back to the U.S., life was not a picnic either.
Mm-hmm. I think that, well, first of all, I'm sure a lot of people are wondering how he ended up in Indiana. And during those 10 years he was in Tokyo, he waited to get his citizenship reinstated. And it wasn't like it's going to take you 10 years. He waited month after month after month for 10 years, which I think is crazy. And, you know, he had a suitcase packed in the beginning of those 10 years. Like, ready to go. He's ready to go. And he never, that suitcase was, like, symbolic of that weight, and so he never unpacked that suitcase because he was always mentally ready to go. But during that time, he needed a skill, to get work when he came to the States. And so he trained to be a chicken sexer, and which is separating the male and the female day-old chicks. And at that time, it was a very lucrative job that many Japanese-American men were going to the United States and doing it during the season, the spring and the summer, and then they were living off the money, the rest of the year. And so my father became, after 10 years, he became really, really good at it because it's a piecemeal job, and accuracy is extremely important, and speed. So the Chick Sexing Association sent him to the Midwest. So that's how he ended up in the Midwest area instead of, say, California or, the Southwest or any place like that. And he traveled around. He was a bachelor when he arrived. And, he traveled around the Midwest, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, Indiana, Ohio. And I think after doing this for a couple of years, he really fell in love with southeastern Indiana. And by that point, too, he had some money saved. He had a car. He had a good paying job. He'd been doing it for several years, and he was being sent back to the hatcheries and the chick nurseries repeatedly. So he had a good job and stability and everything. So, and that's when he decided that he would like to have a Japanese wife. And then he contacted a matchmaker, a mutual friend in Japan, in Tokyo. My father, he never, I think that his experiences would make a totally another book because he never talks negatively about anything. But I know now as an adult that he probably did have, I'm sure he had a really tough time. And he always talks about everyone who is so helpful and people who welcomed him into, their homes and helped him out and, gave him food and things like that. So, and I think that when he worked also after, my mom came over and he's had, three kids and everything, the chick sexing business was starting to become obsolete at that time. And so he got a job working at Cummins Engine in Columbus, Indiana. And I'm sure that was an experience. I'm sure that was an interesting, trying experience for him, but he never really talked openly about specific things that happened or anything like that.
Yeah. How far is Columbus from Versailles?
I'm sorry?
How far from Columbus is Versailles?
It was like a 30-minute, 45-minute drive.
Yeah,
and he worked the second shift. So he would drive, leave the house at 2 o'clock, and then he'd get home like about 11.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then he would moonlight the chick sexing. And so he would work
always working.
Yeah. And then when my two older brothers and I were all in college together, he was selling his vacation time, and it was that was a crazy time for him, like working. But that's one thing that I appreciate so much, and is for him, paying for my tuition and everything for college. I mean, because I, know so many people who've had to pay their own way, and for my parents to get that, give me that gift, gosh, I just appreciate that so much.
Yeah. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is writer Linda Furia. She tells the story of her coming of age in the memoir Bento Box in the Heartland, My Japanese Girlhood in White Bread America. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. Your questions and comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Linda grew up in rural Indiana. She graduated from Purdue. She and her son make their home now in Vermont, where she writes and teaches Japanese and Chinese cooking. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now. A listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello. I just found it so interesting. You know, she's talking a lot about how, you know, she comes to America from Japan, or her family does, and she's constantly trying to fit in. But yet there are so many Americans who want a different life or want to experience something different. You see so many people, it's like she wanted to travel to China. And I found that in my youth, and even now, I always wanted to try something different, which was very convenient living in this university town. So I became a part of a lot of different families of my friends. And I would go over to their houses and eat at Indonesian friends and Pakistani friends. And I ended up falling in love with India to the point where it's like I became Hindu, and it's just almost another part of my life. But still, it's like I had to learn to come back and listen to my mother and her stories and her experiences, and even more, the story she heard from my grandmother, who grew up in England, to appreciate a part of me and a strength of me that was inside of me that I didn't really acknowledge until I heard the stories of what had happened before. So I thought that that was a really interesting perspective to see it from both sides.
Hmm.
So yeah, I'm going to hang up now.
I think that's a really good point. I think, Linda, the reason readers will resonate with your book is because largely it's really a universal story.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and it's, you know, writing it, I didn't want to make it a race story because I think the perfect way for me to kind of explain this is, you know, when, you know, for example, part of girlhood, I think, is, you know, the teasing and, you know, kind of, you know, deciding what your individualism is and you know, who you are at a very young age. And I think luckily for me, I was never a victim of scapegoating or bullying, which I think is a big deal nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
You know, back in the 70s and stuff, I mean, you know, there wasn't a lot of this attention and all this to kids and issues and things like that. And you just, you know, just survive. You just dealt with everything. And I think that when I was growing up, when I was like in between friends, say that I was being scapegoated by a bunch of girlfriends, I'm like, I'm not going to hang out with you. And so I would hang out at the water fountain with, you know, Kenny, the guy that everyone thought was a sissy, and Betty, who was like, you know, had flunked two years and was overdeveloped. And, you know, so we were just kind of like the misfits. And I think that my book kind of resonates a lot with people, you know, people who felt like a misfit, you know, during high school or whatever, who didn't fit in because, you know, they had a lot of freckles, or they had red hair, or they had glasses, or really thick glasses. So it was chubby or whatever. I mean, I've always sort of am drawn to the people who had these differences. And I think that the people who are reading my book, no matter what their experience is, whether it's a race experience or just feeling like they didn't fit in, I think that a lot of people can kind of associate with it.
Hmm. Let's take another call, a listener in Urbana, on line two. Hi.
Hi. My son is half white and half Japanese American. Mm-hmm. And a couple of years ago when he was in first grade and he was bringing his lunches to school, and he brought all different kinds of lunches, including sandwiches and rice balls and things,
mm-hmm.
Some of the kids started to tease him, and it became kind of a problem. And my husband, who grew up in Hawaii, where most people are Asian, went and had lunch with him and kind of educated the other kids and kind of told them, you know, where the food comes from and a little bit about the culture behind the food. And those kids became real interested in the food and stopped teasing and stopped sort of being, I think, kind of feeling like it was very foreign.
That's great.
And it wasn't a problem anymore. And it was,
yeah.
it was just education and, I think, exposure.
I think so, too. I mean, I think it's a shame that happened in the first place. And I think that, you know, I think the teasing happens because people are uncomfortable. They don't know how to express themselves
Exactly.
Except by singling it out. I think that's the beauty of I think nowadays that parents do step in. Parents communicate with their kids. At that time, I mean, this was back, this was like 72. I mean, I wasn't going to discuss this with my mother. I mean, I couldn't. I was in first grade.
Right.
I didn't have the verbal capability to bring this up. And there was a different relationship with teachers back then, too.
Right.
I mean, you just don't want to draw attention to yourself, which I think is a shame. I mean, now I'm so aware, I have a four-year-old son of everything. And I think socially things are better now. But I really do believe that it is, educating and having kids taste the food.
Yeah.
Ignoring it is the worst thing that could happen.
Yeah.
Because that's setting in the other kids' minds that it's okay to, if something's different, it's okay to make fun of it or to belittle it or whatever. And it's setting in your son's mind that, I don't have anybody to protect me.
Right.
I don't have any, I don't want to be different. I don't want to stick out. So I think that's fantastic that, that your husband went and educated and, sat down. And also, too, that the educators let him do that.
Yeah, I think it was a great experience, and it really helped open a lot of doors.
Yeah, and I'm kind of surprised. I mean, I think of that area to be a little bit more open. I know definitely my friends in California and San Francisco, they talk about, oh gosh, they bring these exotic different kind of lunches and stuff, and that's what everybody wants.
Right.
So it's really, really interesting that
Yeah, I grew
how
up.
Varied it is.
I grew up in the Bay Area, and so for us,
right.
all kinds of ethnic food was really normal.
Right.
So
yeah, so lucky.
Yeah. In fact, I mean, I didn't even consider it ethnic food. It was just what we're having today, kind of thing.
Right. Exactly.
So that was a great experience. Well, thanks for your for the show and for your book. Okay. Bye.
Thanks for the call this afternoon, which leads me to ask you a question, Linda, about your dad. And I want to, after we talk about your dad a little bit more, I want to talk some more about your mom. But tell us about your dad's great quest for fresh fish in the Midwest in the 1960s and 70s. We have changed how we eat so radically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was back, my father, because in Japanese food scenes in the culinary world, it's way before Alice Waters and all that, fresh ingredients, I mean, that's like, and with a lot of different cultures, fresh ingredients is huge. And but very difficult in rural Indiana. And my father, He would finding fresh fish was so difficult. I mean, he would actually fish the carp out of the local lake, and then make fish head soup and things like that, which was to my mother's distaste. And so, so because it was so difficult, my father, felt like we had to go and get it, and usually we would get fresh fish. Like we would go twice a year in the spring and the fall. We would drive. It would be like a 12-hour round trip drive to Chicago, and then we would have we would have our sushi, and then my parents would stock up. We would bring this cooler, and they would stock up on shrimp and fish and things like that, and then do that twice a year. Then my father found out something about Florida, and that that there was fresh fish down there, and so he traded in his pickup truck for a Ford station wagon, one of those wood paneled ones, and with the insides like the size of a living room, and this was of course before the gas crisis, and so we took this trip down to Florida, I think it was Panama City, and. My father just went crazy with the crab, the fresh crab and the shrimp. And also while he was there, he tried crabbing and was quite successful. But, he had to kind of,
learn the process of it through, you know, through a difficult way. But yeah, he was. My parents were really quite obsessed with fish. I mean, and that had to have been really hard for them because it's such a mainstay in the Japanese diet, along with the tofu and the miso and the tea. So they did their best. I mean, I think that was probably the hardest thing that they tried to keep in their diet. And I remember my mom, you know, this is when we went to Japan, to Tokyo, back in 76. I don't know how the customs was back then, but she would bring back preserved salmon. I remember her. I don't know if she was smuggling it in or what, but I remember that she would bring that back. And also eel, broiled eel.
Hmm. I suppose if it was preserved, it would be okay.
Yeah. I remember they preserve it in salt.
Oh, okay.
And but it was raw. I don't know.
Well, back to your mom. You know, her life was good as a young single woman in Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
And then she agreed to marry your father. What was it like for her to leave Japan?
When at the time, you know, when I was doing research on this book and I would ask her about it, her famous answer was, "I don't remember." But I mean, I'm sure it was traumatic. And, you know, after a while, you keep asking the same questions over and over again. And of course, I got better about the way I asked my questions.
Mm.
And one day she did tell me that, she would have nightmares about it not working out and then having to come back in shame to Japan. And, you know, people were saying that, you know, she wasn't going to last 6 months and things like that. And so it had to have been really stressful, the uncertainty of it. I mean, that was her future.
It was fun reading how she would steer you in another direction. When you ask these kind of questions, she'd tell you like something like, "I remember what I ate the night before
exactly.
I left."
Which I think is telling in itself, you know, that she remembered these things. And, I mean, that was like her, I think food was always kind of her way of answering a question in a roundabout way.
Yeah. And later, as a young woman, you living in China with your son, who was just a baby then, and your husband, he was fluent in Mandarin.
Mm-hmm.
Your appreciation for your mom's experience really deepened.
Yeah, it really did. And also, I saw a friend of mine who, you know, she was American from California, and her son was already 5 and fluent in Mandarin. And I saw this sort of interaction between those two. And she, you know, he would be like, "Oh, mommy, do you know what?" Like, you know, they would be talking to somebody or something was going on, and of course, you know, her son knew what was being said, and he's like, "Mommy, you know, don't you know what he just said?" And she's like, "No, you know, some of it." And then he would tell her, and then she's like, "Well, we'll tell him this." And so he was playing translator. And I just thought to myself, I mean, and I could tell that she was frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
And I could tell that he was kind of frustrated, too, because he had to do this for his mom. Like, he would kind of do this, "Oh, you know, Mom, I really don't want to do this," sort of thing. And so I'm just like, I couldn't see myself doing that. I couldn't see myself living that after seeing my mom kind of go through that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's why I'm totally amazed after that of how long my mom has lived like that.
Yeah.
And you know, how difficult, because, you know, I was in Shanghai, and that's a huge city. I mean, my mom was like in a small town, and, you know, nobody to really help her. So.
Yeah. Your parents accomplished a great deal.
Yeah, they have. Yeah. And they just take it all in stride. I mean, you know, I was researching this and interviewing them and spending a lot of time with them, and they're like, you know, they were just kind of flabbergasted that people would be interested in this story.
Hmm. It's a good story. Many good Thank stories.
You.
Many good
Thank
stories.
You.
Linda, we have to wrap up here. We're out of time. I want to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. It was fun, and it was great callers.
Okay, very good. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Linda Faria has been our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. She is the author of the memoir, Bento Box in the Heartland, My Japanese Girlhood in White Bread America. The book is published by Seal Press. That's an imprint of Avalon. And you will find our guest online. She has a blog, and the website is www.linda, and then the last name, FURIYA.com.
And that was an interview from the AM 580 Afternoon Magazine archives from May 16th of this year. It's 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices are now in from the Chicago Board of Trade and the Kansas City Board of Trade. With those numbers, here's AM 580 Agriculture Director Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Tom, and good afternoon, everyone. In Kansas City, September wheat had a high price on the day of $6.74, a low of $6.58 3/4, settling at $6.60 1/4, down 1 3/4 on the day. At the Chicago Board of Trade, September wheat, a high on the day of $6.91 1/2, a low of $6.70, settling $6.73 1/2, down 5 1/2. December, a high of $7.10 1/2, a low of $6.88, settling $6.91, down 10. March, a high of $7.01, a low of $6.83, settling $6.83 1/2, down 8 1/2. May, a high of $6.65 1/2, a low of $6.51, settling on its low, down 10 on the day. July, a high of $5.72 1/2, a low of $5.62, settling $5.64, and that was up 1/4. September corn, a high of $3.43, a low of $3.30 3/4, settling $3.32 1/4, down 8 3/4. December, a high of $3.60, a low of $3.47 1/2, settling $3.48 3/4, down 9 1/4. March, a high of $3.74, a low of $3.63, settling $3.64 1/2, down 9. May, a high of $3.83 1/4, a low of $3.73, settling $3.73 1/4, down 10. July, a high of $3.92, a low of $3.81 1/4, settling $3.82 1/4, down 9 1/4. September, a high of $3.95 1/4, a low of $3.87, settling $3.87 1/2, down 8. December of 2008, a high of $4.04, a low of $3.95, settling $3.96 1/4, down 8. March of 2009, a high of $4.07, a low of $4.02 1/2, settling $4.03 1/2, down 7 1/2. September oats, a high of $2.59 1/2, a low of $2.42 1/4, settling $2.52, down 7. The December contract was off 9 1/4 on the day, the high there $2.70 3/4.